You're listening to Talk with Audrey.
After a car accident almost claimed his life, Kenneth James Moore was overcome with a renewed sense of motivation to pursue the promise that he made to his mother at age 8, that he would unravel the mystery behind the disappearance of her youngest brother, Lieutenant Billy Weber, a B-29 bomber pilot during World War II. This pledge led him to Saipan, a U.S.-held island in the Pacific, bringing him face-to-face with the horrific realities of Japanese rule, and the inspiration for his first novel and also his first installment of a trilogy, Pieces of Wood. It explores a dark piece of World War II history not often talked about in the West, bringing to light the atrocities Imperial Japan inflicted on millions of innocent women. Welcome, Kenneth James Moore, to Talk with Audrey.
Audrey, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be on your show, ma'am.
Really appreciate you joining me. Wow, I read this book with great interest. I have to tell you that, and you and I have had a couple of conversations previously, and, you know, it was disturbing, just the topic, the atrocities. But let's start at the very beginning with the title, Pieces of Wood, and how that came about, please.
Most of us in Western society have grown up with the interest of the Nazi regime in Germany and throughout Europe. But very few of us know anything outside of academia that relate to the Japanese, and the atrocities are well beyond the Nazis, and I think you'll be able to see that when you read the novel. But Pieces of Wood, Germans referred to their victims as vermin, or rats, mice that spread disease. The Imperial Japanese had a specific name for their female victims. I'm not going to try to pronounce the Japanese name, but it was Pieces of Wood, translated in English. And so basically, women were looked at as something to use and dispose of. And they did that in mass.
So, and the way that women were used and disposed of was quite disturbing. The first thing I had to do before I really started to read the book, I read your dedication to Minnie Vautrin.
Mm-hmm.
And then right after that, of course, there are some images that I was unfamiliar with in the introduction and an explanation for those images. And I immediately had to Google what went on in World War II with the Imperial Japanese and some of the atrocities that were committed there. And quite honestly, I went into this rabbit hole of article after article after article after article, which then, of course, helped me to better understand your book, Pieces of Wood, and what you wanted to communicate in this historical novel. And I had no idea that these things had happened. It was almost like the atrocities had been covered up and erased from history. You actually went in search of your mother's youngest brother, Lieutenant Billy Weber. You went to Saipan. Tell
Correct.
Us what you saw there.
Well, I had done 27 years worth of what we call first-generation research, and this is, you know, to the very core of what was said or what was written and at the time. And so I accumulated probably close to 1,000 pieces of information, a good deal of which is still spread across my den here at the moment. And it involves interviews and again, first-generation documentation pursuant to what actually was said, what was done at the time when my uncle disappeared. So I went to Saipan after 27 years of doing research per se. I was an investment banker. I traveled around a great deal. And every time I did, I tried to dovetail something or find someone that had something to do with the war in the Pacific from 1939 to 45 from the Western standpoint. And I did that. So I accumulated all this documentation. So by the time I got to Saipan in 1998 for the very first time, I had a good deal of support information. I had a pretty good idea what I was doing. And keep in mind, it's a bit awkward to try to recreate something that occurred, what, at that point, maybe 65 years before I got there. So I had two exceptional friends. One gentleman was given to me by the congressional representative for the Commonwealth of Northern Marianas, and his name is Emmett Suarez. And Emmett grew up on Saipan. And then I had another friend named Glenn Palacios. Glenn and I are quite tight, and he was the dive master of Saipan at the time. So the three of us, in essence, we hit the ground running. I came off of a 22-hour flight, and basically Emmett dragged me and said, hey, we have to go talk to this person or that person. I wanted to find anyone who was alive at that time during World War II who was on Saipan. So for a couple of days, we went to this person's house and that person's house. And the people of Saipan, by the way, are just so heartwarmingly open. Very different, if you will. Pardon me for trying this parallel. But I live in Scottsdale, Arizona. And sometimes the over-commercialism of things has a way to jade one's personality. So it was very refreshing for me to be around people of this nature. So we went again from house to house, and we kept hearing the same story over and over again about the great teachers, what they referred to him as, a fisherman who basically was he was the source of well, he's an uneducated man per se in a formal sense, but he had all this wisdom and all this knowledge about World War II in the Pacific. So, yeah, we finally got to Vicente Santos's home, and he was extremely welcoming, and he put a few pieces of the puzzle together. So, but that's really that was, we were hunting again for my uncle's. My uncle's plane, my uncle's remains, anything pertaining to that. So when we got to Saipan, we heard stories about a B-29 that went down on a on the nearby mountain called Mount Tapachu. And it was indeed a B-29. And so we thought, well, gosh, maybe we ought to go check this out. You know, and because my assumptions had been over those course of 27 years that it went down in water someplace. I had gone through all that data and decided that there were three locations that could have, where the plane could have gone down. And they were, you know, about 1,200 miles apart, but we were willing to go and do that. So we thought it'd be easy to climb the mountain first and figure out what this looked like on dry land, what a crash B-29 looked like on dry land, and it was highly advantageous. So as we are going through the jungle, and this is very difficult for most people to comprehend, but the reality of the jungle in the Mariana Archipelago is astounding. And the last CIA report I read was it was considered to be the most intense jungle on the planet. So we're at about 1,800 foot elevation, I think. I believe that was the height of Mount Tapachu. And, so we're walking through this and tripping, falling, getting cut by a thing called razor grass, R-A-Z-O-R, grass. And it was kind of fun. All of a sudden, you're bleeding all over yourself. But, so the jungle is a very, very difficult place in which to deal with. And it was, temperatures 110 degrees, the humidity probably right very close to that. So it was very trying. And I'm an Arizona guy. I grew up in heat and working in the yards here at my house. It was astounding for me, and it was equally difficult for the other guys too. But they had a degree of assimilation that I did not. So we're going through the jungle, and again, we're looking for this B-29. And we understood through the documentation that I then received while on Saipan that it was shot down on this particular date and this relative location, et cetera. So we're going through the jungle together, and the only way we can see each other is if we wore black shorts or T-shirts, because it's the only color that doesn't generate itself in a jungle. And by the way, there's no trees. This is just all vines. But some of these vines are 20 feet tall. So we're making our way through this, and we come across this rather large orifice. Now, it is unlike what it appears in the opening chapter of the novel, Pieces of Wood. So we just see this big orifice, and we realize that nature never created anything in a perfect circular fashion. So we cleared away the best we could day one, the overgrowth, and then I crawled into it. When I crawled into it, I'm looking at the structure of this entity, and thought it kind of looked like the structure of the skeleton of a boat or the skeleton of an airplane. But the grids, if you will, that were, I think they're called girds, the things that hold the outside of the framework together, weighed about 250 pounds. I crawled in on it. I'm on my belly. I reached under one and tried to pick it up. And I've been a bodybuilder, health nut, vast majority of my life, and I couldn't even budge the darn thing. So it's a quick conclusion to say, this isn't part of an aircraft of any sort. And there were four or six of these things. Oh, and by the way, on the side over my left shoulder was the engraving of the people who had made it. By the way, they're still in business in Japan. So, it turned out to be a crematorium. We referred to them as the ovens. And there were the two that were still standing that we cleared away. But there was a whole trail of broken bricks. And if you look carefully, that trailer is pretty close to being the extent of an American football field. So there was a lot of these, but there were two that were immediately available that we could clear away and thereby took the photos of. So it turned out to be a crematorium. And as I was kind of figuring out what it was, as I'm laying here again on my chest, I'm kind of digging with my hands through the residue at the bottom of this thing, and it was very dusty, and it turned out to be that was where 5,000 women were cremated alive, and it was a horrible experience. There was there was these different colors as I was going through. I said, well, I know the Imperial Japanese didn't wear blue, or they didn't wear, you know, bright green or yellow. Where the hell are these things coming from? You know, how did they originate in here? And so it turned out that was the case. And then, as I said, I interviewed a lot of people, and I came across a gentleman who was there, a Chicago businessman who was a Marine Corps colonel, who was there the day after the atrocities, don't know what other term to use, took place. He said that it was, from what he could tell, they were mostly women. And there's another indication of that, too, because what the Japanese were known to do is to tie their victims up in lines. Stripped the women naked, and they would wrap barbed wire around them, and the barbed wire would also go around their throat. So if they moved in any way, they would cut themselves as well as the person next to them. And as they were lined up in front of the oven, they would be a snipping sound, and just a ton of these snippets lying on the ground outside of these ovens. So that seemed highly decorative to me that was indeed the case. although, and then third off, there was a plaque there left by, try to wrap your head around this one, a North Korean Christian missionary who traveled in 1945, we believe, with this plaque to place it next to these ovens. I mean, we tried to find that guy, but it wasn't possible with the current political situation. But wow, he carried that darn thing from North Korea to Saipan and placed it next to these ovens. And he referred to these people as the white clad people. And if that's basically indicative of Koreans, they wear white, normally speaking. So, yeah, it was quite an experience. But as I came through all this, I have to also put this in historical perspective from my standpoint, and that is in 1981, I was living in Annapolis, Maryland, and I had, with my wife, we were watching TV commercials about self-defense for women, you know, reach into your purse and pull out a gun or pull out the mace. I rather largely heralded martial arts expert at the time, and I'm just cracking up. I said, that's just ridiculous, because, you know, by the time you do that, the woman is on the ground either, you know, bleeding out or raped. And that just was anathema to everything that I could think of. So I created a class. I was told it was the first of its kind. It was sanctioned by the YWCA, and I taught it at the University of Maryland College Park campus for quite some time, maybe close to a year, before I passed it on to my senior students. But that would you know, simple self-defense techniques that would save a woman's life. So when I'm crawling to the oven, I'm thinking about this. I'm thinking about that. Holy crap, this pandemic of violence against women is just so out of control. Now, I don't consider myself to be any kind of champion per se of the cause. It just seems to me to be a reality check. How does a society, and you must look at it on a grander scale, how does society survive when one half of said society feels subjugated to the other? It makes no sense. It's certainly not for the prolongation of said society. So I did not set out to write a novel about violence against women, nor did I set out to write a novel that depicted the Imperial Japanese in such a fashion. But honestly, it is almost impossible when you're digging through archives not to come across these Imperial Japanese atrocities. It was so widespread and so barbaric. And I do like to point out one fact that, you know, again, the Nazis were fanatics. No question about that. It was horrible. But the Imperial Japanese were barbaric. They ate their victims. I'm going to say that one more time. They ate their victims. And this had nothing to do, for the most part, with being cut off from supplies either by or having our Navy cut off the islands or the Imperial Japanese feeding their troops properly. This was a manifestation of the Imperial Japanese court. It is so barbaric and so widespread that there's actually a new report out by a Japanese Japanese nationalist who lives in Australia, who's a professor there, and who wrote a more dynamic interpretation of the cannibalism or how widespread it was. At the time during World War II, Chichi Jima, the sister island to Iwo Jima, was well known as a cannibal outlet for the Imperial Japanese, and nobody really wanted to go down in that area, including former President H.W. Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, who was shot down near Chichijima. All this was going through my mind as I'm laying there on my chest, digging through the remains of the people who were there in 1944, in July of 1944.
So I'm curious. I can't imagine, and I don't think anyone else could, but as you discovered these crematoriums where these hundreds of thousands of women were burned alive, their ages ranging from, you know, young pubescent girls to 70-year-old women who were deemed no longer necessary. And they were taken as part of the Comfort Women program during the war. But when you went into that crematorium and you are crawling through there, did you ever get a sense that you were also crawling through the ashes of the people who,
yes,
the people who were,
yes,
cremated there? And was that horrifying? And what did you think and feel when you, or did you feel the evil, the wickedness, the derangement, the horror of what happened there?
You mean as I sorted through, several dozen little tiny black shoes and all these different colors and all the sake bottles and God, yeah. I mean, I consider myself a human being, and Jesus, I don't think you have to be, you'd have to be damn near dead yourself not to feel some connection. And I really like, and that's why I quoted my associate, Jeff Gorley, in the opening chapters of Pieces of Wood. Jeff was a Air Force Special Forces operative, a search and rescue expert. Jeff is just one serious badass person. Okay, he really is. He's a tech diver. If you want to look up what a tech diver is, those people are whacked out. I thought I was crazy, but he broke down, and I had no idea Jeff was that competent an author. Or he drafted that letter that's in the opening chapter of Pieces of Wood. He drafted that himself, and this is not a person you look at and think of him having any kind of literary skills, but he did a beautiful job of describing just how horrific it is. And if Jeff is that taken by it, it was abominable. It was something I obviously lived with for the rest of my life.
And you had to write that, you know, you had felt so compelled that you had to include that information in Pieces of Wood. Did the people of Saipan, were they clearly had to have been aware what had happened there, because history, even though it's silent, somebody knows exactly what happened. How did they feel about what they heard was up there or what they knew was in the jungle? And they probably even had relatives who were victims as well.
That's quite possible. That's a difficult question, because I'd have to go back to the fact that the jungle itself is so intense. There are also these horrible stories about, I'll just categorize them as leprechauns that live in the jungle. And so people never really went up Mount Tapacho. In fact, we were told not to go up Mount Tapacho because now it's like giving us a green light. But I don't feel that there was a great deal of knowledge of what was going on up there. I also like to think that that's why the Japanese put it on this Calderas plain at the top of a once active volcano called Mount Tapacho. And that's how I sum it. But I can't say I surveyed every person on Saipan at that juncture, but I would say overall, it was not like the German families that were escorted through Buchenwald, Auschwitz, or Dachau, where they could see the remains. No, I just don't feel it was the same scenario.
The other thing, and guys, we still have a lot more to talk about. This is a big book, but when you think about those atrocities committed by men. All men have, they were given birth to by women. All men have daughters. All men have mothers and grandmothers. And it makes you wonder why women are so devalued when without women you do not exist. Right?
Yeah.
You don't exist. And so I've never understood violence against women. I don't know that in my lifetime we'll ever solve this issue, because it seems to cut across all ethnicities, cultures, you name it. It just seems just cut through all segments.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what, as I read the book, I just kept thinking about that over and over and over and over again. But Pieces of Wood and what Kenneth James Moore came upon in Saipan while looking for his mother's youngest brother, Tenant Billy Weber, was the history that he decided to include in the book. But the book is a novel. So if you would set the stage for us, Kenneth, the novel part is about a well-educated Japanese man seeking revenge for atomic bombs being dropped on his country. So tell us about that story and how then Pieces of Wood becomes intertwined and interwoven with history, the stark realities of history.
Thank you for bringing that up, because that's often overlooked, and respectfully with other people with whom I've held interviews. But yes, the idea was to tell a story that was relatable, and it is an international crime thriller. We have two FBI agents who were boyfriend-girlfriend in high school who were in a unwittingly to either one, became FBI agents. They team up with a gentleman who was a Marine Corps colonel who was at the site on July 1944. And although he is fictitious in the novel, he is the real person who I interviewed, who told me about these, what he saw there that particular day. But yeah, that's why I posed this, because I wanted to show people just how bad this really was. It is an atrocity that has been swept under the table for so long. I feel the need to get it out, sweep it out from underneath the cover that it has existed under for so long, put it up on a pedestal and point our fingers at it. Because this isn't science fiction. This isn't, you know, something make-believe. This was real. And by the way, it was 2.2 million, best estimate, for those of us into that kind of thing, of comfort women. By the way, these were not women. That's just the Imperial Japanese just love using these euphemisms to cover up their atrocities. Those were all prepubescent girls torn from their families, where they're watching their families being butchered while they're being dragged off and thrown into the back of a truck, taken here and there. And there's one, well, that was, I'm sorry, I've got a little carried away there for a moment. There was one scenario where these three women from China were wound up in Malaya. You know, it's quite a hike. They were passed around, as all the conquered women were, passed around from this to that, from this part to that party, raped, and then mutilated, and then destroyed. You know, because frankly, if the Americans saw that or had evidence of that, if the American people really were outraged and knew about this, well, a couple guys named General Norstad and General Curtis LeMay, who wanted to just continue to nuke the Japanese, but it probably got their way. And maybe something, and you were referring to this, Audrey, but you know, this is such an ongoing plague. The subject of violence against women is a pandemic, in my opinion, far more dangerous than COVID-19 and far more damaging and difficult to stop than SARS or even the bubonic plague. According to FBI statistics, of what, maybe year, last year's, I think they were. There's a rape every 6 minutes in the United States, and four women are killed by the batterers every day. But one of the statistics that I recently got was from the RCMP in Canada, the National Police, which states categorically that 45% of all women will experience some form of violence before the age of 16. What the F is that? Seriously, we look at Canada, we feel these people to be far more peaceful and open than we are, and yet 45% of all the women before the age of 16 will experience some form, that is a quote, by the way, some form of violence before the age of 16. Nuts. And every day there's this stuff about underage girls being victimized by wannabe Jeffrey Epstein's. It is a plague, and it does need to stop. Now, I was trying to say, and particularly in chapter one, I'm trying to point out that this is it starts with one situation, and that's what I described in chapter one. One situation where this a Christian zealot woman is seeking revenge against everybody she can, indiscriminately. And she's shot and killed and not brought before a court. And the comments in there say, well, this is going to happen. These women are going to continue, my God. So we need to do something about it. Seriously, that's how it happens. And then it just escalates from there. And I love women. I always have. I mean, I prefer the company, actually, over my own gender. But it's just, I think pieces of wood must be seen as a warning to current generations that if light isn't shed on the horrors of the past, there's nothing more horrific than the Imperial Japanese during World War II. History can and ultimately will repeat itself. I mean, that's a cliche, perhaps, but it's also a truism.
So the other thing that occurs to me is, and you mentioned this in Pieces of Wood as well, is that the memory of the history is passed down from generation to generation. So what you have are men who have committed atrocities, and perhaps their fathers told them about it or mistreated them at home. And so it's learned and ingrained, which is why it might continue. And I don't know how you stop that. Part of it is just straight out denial. You know, we as human beings don't want to believe that we're capable of such heinous atrocities, but true, obviously we are. And it's going to take men changing and men talking with other men and recognizing the inhumanity that some men harbor within them, right? In order any of this to change. Otherwise, these atrocities and just the violence against women is just going to continue. And as I read the book, I'm like, wow, you know, as a young pubescent girl, you don't even know what's happening to you.
Of course you don't.
You don't understand what's happening to you. Your body is being assaulted. You're being raped. You're being... And then thrown away and burned alive because you're no longer of use?
And you don't want to have... Your body represents evidence. And in Western society, evidence goes a long way. So they wanted to destroy any possible evidence. So they burned them.
And they even, by the way, guys, if you do some research, if the women became pregnant, they also eliminated that child. They cut that baby out of the woman's body while the woman was still alive. Yep. They experimented on them very much in the way that it happened to Black women during slavery and certainly during the Holocaust and other atrocities that have happened around the world. But it's this disregard for life. It's almost like you're not human. You're just there to serve, right?
You're pieces of wood.
Yeah, it's sickening.
You're just pieces of wood.
It's sickening. Yeah. It was so hard for me to read, Kenneth. I'm sorry. It was hard to read, but I felt like I had to read it because you need to know. We all need to know the truth of what goes on. And you obviously did a lot of research in writing pieces of wood, and you wove it very well into the novel part of the book. Guys, it's not a novel and an historical perspective. It is a historic novel. So the information is woven into the story that he is telling about what happened and how it's perpetuated and that kind of violence and the signals that you get from the past that come into the future in really strange ways.
Well, if I may address the question of how do you stop this pandemic? First of all, I think people have to start looking at it from a social standpoint, from the overall picture, the big picture, if you will. Because I think from a police standpoint or even our legal system overall, each of these cases where there is abuse against women or a level of violence direct towards women is recognized. I think, first of all, the laws have to be far more punitive than what they are now. I think they have to be seen as really a crime against humanity, not just a crime against that particular person, but a crime against us all. It is, in my opinion, a crime against humanity and should be addressed accordingly. That might seem very harsh, but Jesus, I don't think so, because I had a situation where when I first taught the self-defense women class in Maryland, I had a police detective, a female police detective, following me around and addressing what I was doing. And I finally won her over, and that felt really good, because they were saying to me, it's not brutality. It has some deeply ingrained realities in the male who is doing this. Pardon me, but I said, BS to that. You've got to be kidding me. This is physical violence, and I don't care what the underlying consequences are. The physical reality is evident and needs to be addressed accordingly. And again, as a social matter, not just as a one time and then another and another. It has to be seen and portrayed as a crime against humanity. And to that extent, again, I sincerely applaud the YWCA, and most of the YWs and YMs now are integrated. There are boys and girls clubs, for example, and I think that that's ideal, because these kinds of things, and if I would love to speak in front of a boys and girls club with the parents present, and just lay out some of these things. I think it needs to be told straight up, because this is a straight up reality. It's ongoing. And in my opinion, it's the only way it's going to stop or slow down. Well, I'll accept the slow down. Can I just add this little thing? And thank you, by the way, for mentioning it was a trilogy. But one of the things there's just so much here. Most of the people that read this thing or come across this thing, these are just Asian women, so yeah, it doesn't really matter that much. BS. They were not. They were nurses, teachers, fruit farmers, women wanting to get away from their abused husbands from Australia, France, Germany. And keep in mind that we were all these countries, except for us, which I'm rather, we should all be very proud of us for not participating, established colonies in this community or throughout Central Asia. And so we had, again, women who were from all walks of life and all nationalities who were, treated accordingly, as we've already discussed. So it's a crime, in my opinion, that sweeps the globe.
Yeah, then, the news story's out about women who are serving their country being assaulted by men in the military. And it's like, when does this stop? When does it stop? Guys, check out this book. It's called Pieces of Wood by author Kenneth James Moore. And there's also a trailer, a book trailer that you can catch as well. Kenneth, give us your website address, if you would.
For Pieces of Wood, it's simply www.piecesofwood.com. .net. And please make sure it's .net, because if you use .com, you go to a high school woodworking shop. www.piecesofwood.net. Or you can just type in my name, Kenneth James Moore, and then everything about me and the books and all this other stuff will pop up, and you probably will learn more about me than you care to. But the reality, it's all out there. It's 100%. I'm 100% visible. So Kenneth James Moore, period.
And of course, you can get the book on Amazon and everywhere books are bought. So let's not forget that. My guest has been Kenneth James Moore, the author of Pieces of Wood. It's a novel based on actual and historical events. According to Amazon, they're number one best-selling author for the past several weeks. Check out this book, visit the website, and do your homework. It's a lot to take in, but well worth the read. Thank you so much, Kenneth James Moore, for joining me.
Thank you, Audrey.
It's my pleasure.